PCS question.
Yes.
You mentioned that there are some phase-based constraints which penalizes like general k to k plus q scattering.
Yes.
Whereas the k minus k to k prime minus k prime scattering is not suppressed.
Right.
Why does that happen?
Oh. Essentially because you have infinitely many states to scatter to without changing your kinetic energy. So maybe a more illustrative way to see is this. Imagine you have an ugly Fermi surface, right? So before we did a spherical, like a nice symmetric one. Imagine your Fermi surface looks like this. It's not entirely impossible. Sorry, let me. Right, it's still a smooth one, but suppose it looks like something like this. Now you have problem because if you take this and this, right? If you try to conserve momentum and scatter to some other state, for example, this one, it has a much higher kinetic energy. Right, so this is your Fermi C. So these two have very low energy, but these two have very high energy. These two are pretty far away from Fermi C, right? So essentially, because of the nice symmetry of the spherical Fermi surface, that if I have k minus k sufficiently close to the Fermi surface, there are infinitely many k prime minus k prime states that are equally close to the Fermi surface. Turns out that's guaranteed by inversion and time reversal symmetry. So if you break these symmetries badly enough, you end up with this situation. And it turns out there, the BCS scattering, like this type of scattering, will be penalized again. And then you don't have the BCS instability in those. Yeah, so sometimes you may hear words like a Fermi liquid is inevitably unstable at low temperature because of BCS instability. That's not entirely true. That's only true if you have nice enough symmetry, inversion, time reversal. Okay, so any other questions? Okay, good. So today we go slightly beyond Landau theory. We add another name, essentially, to the theory. It's now called Ginsburg-Landau. And then I'll tell you why the superconductor is a superconductor. The Meissner effect, which is also known in a slightly different incarnation as the Anderson-Higgs mechanism. Okay. So let's start from Landau again. But now let's remember that there is such a thing called the electric magnetic field in nature. And our Cooper pairs carry charge 2E. So they should couple to electric magnetic field somehow. So what we do now is to have Landau plus minimal coupling to the EM gauge field. So let's consider a gauge where the scalar potential is zero. You know, it's convenient to do that. So this is basically what's called Ginsburg-Landau. So what the free energy, let's just consider the vector potential. So phi is zero. So that looks like this. So let me work at temperature below TC. So I actually have a non-zero pairing. So then it looks like this. Where B is some positive number, which I showed you before. Right, remember C squared number. This number is proportional to Tc minus T. So yeah, but if you put A equal to zero, this is exactly the Landau theory I wrote you yesterday. The only difference is now I remember that phi is a Cooper pair. So it should couple to the electromagnetic field. And the minimal way to introduce that is just to modify your derivative to a gauge, to a covariant derivative. I assume you've seen this somewhere, maybe in your field theory class. So so now let me do another thing, which is suppose I'm reasonably deep within the superconductor. Then I can just expand. So I know at mean field level, I have some phi zero, right, which you remember it's something proportional to stuff like 1 over 2 c squared times b. Is there a 2? Yeah, I think there's a 2. Yeah. So it's proportional to some tc minus t. Right, so there is an expectation value. So now let me expand this phi around this phi naught. But let me expand it in a particular way. Let me expand in terms of an amplitude fluctuation and a phase fluctuation. So what do I expect? Well, OK, you can just plug this in into this one and see what you get. Well, first of all the linear order terms will be gone, because phi naught, by definition, minimizes the free energy. So linear order terms should be gone. And then what you will get is this. Get 1 half rho s partial theta minus 2a squared plus 1 half partial delta phi squared plus 1 over 2 c squared delta phi squared plus high order terms. So let's just keep everything to second order. Turns out that's sufficient. Okay. And let me say rho s is something like, I think, phi naught squared.
That's the free energy.
Sorry?
Does the free energy work?
Yes, yes, yes. So let me see. You just expand this whole thing in this way, and that's what you get. Okay.
Not.
Sorry?
Who is A naught? The second line says A naught equals zero or something.
Second line, A naught.
Oh, sorry. It's the scalar potential. The scalar potential. The electric, the V. Yeah. Which means that I'm only coupling to a vector potential. Yes. So yeah, I think that's correct. So this rho s, remember, it's again proportional to Tc minus T. So now you look at the pattern, right? Suppose let's suppose T is below Tc and well below, so that this is not a small number. Okay, so it's of order one. Then what do I get? I get a term with a phase fluctuation partial theta square, and two terms that describes the amplitude fluctuation that looks like this. In particular, there is this term in the amplitude fluctuation. That means that so if I look at this theory, it means that if I measure my amplitude fluctuation, let's say if I think about the correlation function, this goes as at large distance e to the minus x over c. So if I look at distance well above the c scale, the scale set by the c, which is a finite number now, this amplitudes basically don't fluctuate. They're frozen. or in relativistic term, this amplitude fluctuation comes with a mass.
How did you do that calculation?
From here to here?
Yeah.
Okay. So the way you do it is, all right. So now let's call this thing just to save space. And let me call this thing phi, which may look familiar. Call it little phi. Then you take essentially this theory. You do it in Fourier space, right? Then in Fourier space, you'll see that this thing looks like k squared plus 1 over c squared. Now you do Fourier transform. You get this.
So quite literally, we're taking like a path integral over the possible phis using that action f and
yes.
delta phi is
yes.
multiplying that exponential.
Yes. I mean, since you've been learning about phi-4 theory, I can maybe say a bit more. So this is a path integral, if you like, in three-dimensional Euclidean signature. So if you interpret that as a 2 plus 1D theory in Euclidean space-time, then an action like this means that my phi field has a mass, which is given by 1 over c. Right? So this statement, the statement that if I go to long enough distance, the correlation is suppressed, is equivalent to say if I go to energy scale much below my mass, then that particle doesn't get excited. I mean, it's essentially a weak rotated version of that statement. Okay.
Where is the correlation function in the momentum space coming from? You wrote that's equal to 1 over k squared plus 1.
In momentum space, it looks like up to some factor of 1/2, which let's not worry about it. It looks like this, phi k, phi minus k. So this is the Fourier transform of this guy.
Okay.
And then this is a Gaussian integral. And then you can, yeah.
So that's Wick's theorem.
Sorry?
That is Wick's theorem of action, right? That the correlator between phi k and phi minus k is going to be 1 over the thing that is multiplying.
That by itself is not Wick theorem. That's just Gaussian integral.
Yeah.
Wick theorem will be, say, you take a four-point function and it separates. Yeah, we're not even doing that. Okay. So all this is just to tell you, if I go to a length scale much above c, which I can if I'm not too close to the to TC, right? If T is reasonably below TC, then I can neglect this amplitude fluctuation. So what am I left with? The only thing now is the phase fluctuation, the theta. So the action, or the Landau free energy, the Ginsberg-Landau free energy, will reduce to something of this sort, right, with rho as a positive number. So this is the, I would say, the most important equation that describes essentially most of the phenomenology, interesting phenomenology of superconductivity. So most of the cool stuff of superconductivity will come out of this. Okay. And this rho s has a name. Well, sometimes it's called the phase stiffness. It's just saying that if I try to twist my theta phase in space, there's some energy cost associated with that, and that scale is set by this stiffness rho s. So now let's study this this free energy. So first of all, let's minimize with respect to the theta. Okay? Essentially taking the equation of motion, if you like. Well, there's no time, but it's the analog of taking equation of motion. What do you get? Well, you get this gradient. By the way, I'm using partial vector and gradient vector interchangeably. Hopefully, that doesn't cause any confusion. And essentially, it's saying this vector has zero divergence. And now another thing which I can do is let's ask what is the electric current or electron current. Remember, once you couple your system to a vector potential, the current has a definition, which is by definition it's given by minus delta f delta a. It's a functional derivative of your free energy with respect to the vector potential. Then you just plug this in again. You see that the current is given by 2 rho s times rho minus 2a. So these are the two important equations that will give you all the magic.
Is current defined that way? Why are we taking the variation with respect to A?
Yeah, okay. So, for example, this is what you get from the Noether procedure. I mean, that's a formal way to say it. The other way to say it is the other more hand-waving way to say is you expect when you add a current, when you couple the system to a vector potential, the coupling should formally look something like this. This is not the most precise way to say it, but formally should look like this. Because when you write it this way, gauge invariance implies conservation of charge, right? Because if I do a gauge transform, let's say I change A to partial alpha dot J, by a partial integration, it becomes alpha gradient of J in both space and time. So let me use the space-time just to give you an intuition. But by continuity equation, this should be zero. So this kind of coupling naturally links gauge invariance to current conservation. That's a quick and dirty way to see it. But to be more precise, you should follow the Noether procedure. You see that? That's what, yes.
Is gauge invariance or any other symmetry?
Sorry?
Is gauge invariance or is any other symmetry? Like the one that we used to use?
The one I just used, that's gauge invariance. Yeah, that's saying I should always be free to modify my A by a total derivative.
Okay, so I'm confused because as I understand, when you use the Noether's theorem, you use it for like symmetries, but gauge invariance is not
symmetry. Yeah. So, gauge invariance is not a symmetry, but it's an invariance. So you should always impose that your theory is invariant under that. So yeah. But the thing is, the Noether procedure works even if the symmetry is a strict gauge symmetry. What you will find, if it's a strict gauge symmetry, what you will find is that J is zero. But you still get an expression of J first. I think that's sometimes known as the second Noether procedure or something. Yeah. So let's take these two equations and see what that means. So the first thing we can see is that this is the vector potential plus a total derivative of something. Right? So it's very tempting, and in fact, we will be doing to set a gauge to essentially absorb this partial theta into the A. So now, pick a gauge, which is, let's redefine, let me call A tilde as A minus 1/2 gradient of theta. Right. This seems to be a reasonable gauge to pick. So then the theory, the two equations further simplify. It's just saying that my electric current is just minus 4 rho s A tilde. This is known as a London equation. Then this is just saying that the gradient of this A tilde is 0. This looks like a gauge fixing condition. And in fact, this also has a name. It's called the Coulomb gauge. Yes.
Why in the free energy? That's the free energy, right?
Yes.
Why don't you include the energy density by EMP?
You can. In fact, you should.
But
I haven't done it here.
But then the current, like you will have additional terms.
Yes. I haven't included that here. I'll do it later. But for now, let's just do this. In fact, the difference between okay, I'll discuss later that this is more appropriate if this A field is more like a probe field rather than a dynamical EM gauge field. But okay, I'll say more on that.
You're seeing it's a background field?
Yes. But we'll see the consequence later. Right. So what does that mean? Right. So now if I take a uniform AC electric field, right, essentially let's say E, E is E times E to the minus I omega t. Okay. So remember, I can pick a gauge in which E is partial TA. You say tilde, which basically means A tilde in Fourier space or in frequency space. In frequency space, that's like I omega T A tilde equal to E. Okay. So now plug that in to this expression you see in magic, which is J E is 4 rho over I omega. E, which means my AC conductivity is 4 rho s minus I omega. So first of all, there's an I here, which means this is non-dissipative. Furthermore, it blows up as omega goes to 0. That's basically superconductivity. It's saying that your conductivity goes to infinity. But let's be a little bit more sophisticated and ask what does that really mean? Okay. First of all, this result on its own is not that surprising. Because if you take a normal metal and suppose you make it infinitely clean, you get exactly that. Okay. Just because of Newton's law, second law. Remember, if I take a normal metal, I just say that the dV dt m is equal to E, right? And then I say my current, which is defined as density times V, will just be essentially density over m time integral of E. right? So if I set a constant E, this J will just accelerate forever. And if you put in an AC field, you get pretty much this. Okay? So if it's infinitesimally clean, this is not a non-trivial result, actually. Okay? What is non-trivial about superconductivity is that even if I add some weak impurity, this result is still true. While here, if I add some impurity, what I should do, you'll remember, is to add a dissipative term, like this. So this immediately changes the structure. So you remember your conductivity at AC will become something like NE over M times 1 over 1 over tau plus I omega. Right? So the behavior as omega goes to 0 is completely dominated by this 1 over tau dissipation term. That's for a normal metal. The funny thing about superconductivity is that when I get conductivity from this approach, adding weak disorder doesn't actually do much, right? Because this doesn't come from some Newtonian equation. Let me just say that turns out weak disorder can change, for example, rho s. It can make rho s smaller in a superconductor. That can do. But will not change the qualitative structure. In particular, the fact that the conductivity is still non-dissipative and blows up at zero frequency, that's unchanged. So the cheating way to argue for that is basically when I derive this Ginzburg-Landau theory for you. Remember yesterday we started with a few assumptions. Right? You have some Hoover pair condensate, and then you just write down the lowest order free energy terms, and then you minimally couple it to a gauge field. I didn't assume anywhere that the system is clean, really. Right. So, which means even with some dirt, all my arguments should still apply. So if you're not entirely happy with that, so let me give you another example. Another argument. It's really a very closely related argument. Why there's no dissipation when I have a current? So another argument. So suppose I start with a normal metal. Right, so suppose this is my momentum space. Okay. Suppose I start from a normal metal. And my ground state is a field Fermi C like this. And suppose I excite the system with the electric field for some time or put some condition so that the system gets a current in the way that the entire Fermi surface is shifted slightly away from the ground state. Okay, so this gives me a current. So now if I turn off the electric field, I just let the current stay like this, what will happen? Well, you will relax back to the ground state. Okay. Well, how do you do that? You can't just, that can't just happen on its own because that doesn't conserve momentum, right? So what you need is some impurity that, for example, scatter this electron randomly to here, for example, this electron to here, this electron to here. And then by doing a lot of scattering by the impurities, the system gradually relax to the original position. Okay? And the time it takes is about tau, the mean free time. Okay? And in particular, this scattering doesn't cost me energy. Okay, so let's say if I start from this k and end at this k prime, typically ck and minus ck prime won't be large. In fact, it can be negative, meaning by doing that scattering, I gain energy. Then that will happen. Okay, so that's how you get dissipation in a normal metal.
So
why when you have the disorder, you can break the momentum conservation?
Because the presence of disorder breaks translation symmetry. Have a particle there. Or it's just, you know, it's really just scattering, right? I have a potential here, I have k here, then there's this probability of scattering to any other k. Yeah, that's why if I have a absolutely clean metal at zero temperature, the conductivity is going to be infinite. But having infinite conductivity on its own may simply mean that you somehow have a ridiculously clean sample. So what happens to superconductor in the same picture? Well, so let's see. So suppose this is my momentum space again, and I draw the same picture. This is the ground state. And suppose for some reason you get a current like this. Now I want to play the same game. But now there is a problem. This fermion is paired with this fermion in a bound state with binding energy delta. So if I want to just scatter this fermion to, let's say, here, I can't just do it. I have to break the pair first. Right, so this k to k prime scattering requires pair breaking. And there is an energy barrier for me to do that. Of order delta. Okay, which means if I'm at temperature much below delta, then that's getting very hard to do. And then what happens is that the system decides not to relax. So this pattern stays there forever. That's how you get the persistent current in superconductor. Yes?
So pair breaking is happening because momentum is not conserved otherwise, or?
Yeah, basically, I mean, this fermion is paired with this one, but not paired with this one.
Why can you, for the Cooper pair, you simultaneously scatter two electrons to the new momentum?
I think that's also suppressed. Yeah, okay. To see that, you need an actual calculation. But yeah, I'm trying to show you the picture without doing the actual calculation, which is a little bit messy. Well, it's not that messy. Yes.
Isn't there maybe like, could there be like instability, like if there is this energy barrier?
Yes.
Like it would take maybe some time to break one Cooper pair, but once we break this, maybe is the fact that we reduce the number of Cooper pair making it easier to break Cooper pairs, and then it.
I don't know. Turns out no. Yeah. Again, this simple intuition may not be able to. Say that much. Yeah, again, everything I said can be shown more rigorously through an actual calculation, but let me not do it here. Okay. So you get a persistent current without E. Also, another consequence of this is that if the current is too large, then this picture breaks down. Right? If let's say my Fermi surface moved to here, and then this one has a much higher energy than any particle here. So even if I have a delta energy barrier for the pair breaking, it's still always good to relax to a much lower energy state. Right? So which means there is a what's called an upper critical current. Meaning if the current is larger than this JC, then it's no longer superconducting, becomes dissipative again. But an actual estimate of this JSA requires a little bit more work. And in fact, it requires taking into other process into account, not only just this. So let me not do it here. Just tell you the qualitative structure. Yes?
So can there be a case in which this scattering happening and it balances off the change in energy without the pair breaking?
I don't know what that means.
I mean, so is there a way to conserve momentum by accounting change in energy by scattering?
Yeah, that you have to do an actual calculation. And no, I think the answer is no.
Can you go over the picture once again? Because if there's a pair, like,
yeah.
Don't quite follow the argument. So there's a pair.
Yeah.
You want to scatter one of the electrons in it to the initial state, whatever that was.
Yeah.
So that causes a problem with conservation momentum. Is that?
No. That the real problem is you have to lift that particle out of the bound state first, and then you can scatter, because this state is not this particle is yeah maybe that's your question. This particle is not paired with this one, right? It's only this one that's paired with this one. Right.
First, we have to break the pair in order to do.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the persistent current. Now let's go back to the clean case. Yes?
How does the presence or absence of impurity modify the free energy expression?
Yeah, so it turns out what will happen is if you have disorder, the form of the free energy doesn't change. What changes is are those numbers. For example, C can change. And because C changes, the rho S will also change. Right? So the phase stiffness typically get reduced once you have disorders. Right. So now let's Now let's go back to the clean case and consider something that's in some sense more intrinsic to a superconductor than the persistent current. Because to understand the persistent current, you somehow sort of have to think about disorder, which is a little bit nasty, as you can see from the fact that I'm not willing to show you the actual calculation. The reason is persistent current will be trivial if you don't have disorder. So now let's consider something that would be non-trivial even if you don't have disorder. So in some sense, more intrinsic. So let's consider the effect of a time-independent magnetic field. Okay. And now let me take into account, now let me finally remember that electromagnetic field has its own dynamics. There's a Maxwell equation. If you like, in the free energy, there should be a B squared term. Okay. So Maxwell tells us that curl of B is given by 4 pi times JE. I'm using the Gaussian unit. Right, so this has to be true. Now let's take all those statements into account. What does that mean? Well, the left-hand side, remember, it's gradient of curl A, which you just pull out your vector calculus textbook or even just Wikipedia. See, it's this. And now let's take the gauge where this A really means A hat. So in Coulomb gauge, this thing vanishes, has zero divergence. So I'm only left with the Laplacian term. What about the right-hand side? Well, the right-hand side, as I said, the current, the major contribution comes from chi rho s, just by London equation. So if I equate this two, I get possibly the simplest equation you can have in the this equation. This one is pretty easy to solve. Well, okay, it's a little bit nasty to work with A, it's vector potential. So let's take curl on both sides. Then what you get? You get this Laplacian of magnetic field is equal to rho s. Let me redefine this number, call this 1 over lambda L squared. So this lambda L is called the London's, it's called the penetration depth. I'll show you in 10 seconds why that's the case. Penetration depth. So just look at this equation. What does that mean? So suppose I have this scenario. So I have, let's say, a superconductor and a vacuum and a boundary. Okay, so just take a piece of superconductor, and this is my surface. Okay. So, and suppose I have a magnetic field out of my superconductor in the vacuum. Right? Let's say it's a constant magnetic field. So what does this equation do? Let me call this axis x. Okay. So this equation, if you solve it by imposing the boundary condition that B should be B0 at x equal to 0 on the surface, then you see that as you go into your superconductor, this B0 decays quickly, exponentially actually, in the superconductor. In fact, you can see that dx is B0 times e to the minus x over lambda L. Yes?
I have a question. Maybe it's an assumption we made for a long time, but like, if we apply a magnetic field,
yes,
the field inside could depend also on the way if the electrons start moving,
yeah,
the field that other electrons will feel will be different, right? If I apply B, I'm the controller of my experiment, but then inside the crystal, I don't know what's.
Yeah. So it's, yeah, there what you have control is H. Right. So you have magnetization and so on. Yeah, that's why it's gonna, so let's assume you have some control of magnetic field outside. And then the question is, what does that mean inside? Right. So this means after a length lambda L, the field is essentially zero. So that's the fact. That's just the phenomenon that a superconductor repels magnetic field. So if I make it more drastic, if I have a piece of superconductor here, and I try to apply a magnetic field, if the magnetic field is not too strong, then what will happen is that it does something like this. Outside, I can make it uniform, but the magnetic field lines get repelled. Yes.
What happens at the surface?
Yes. You can ask what happens on this surface. Well, remember you still have to obey Maxwell equation, and here you can see that there is a curl B, which means there is a current JE here, and in fact that's another way to understand this this magnetic field repulsion, what happened is that there would be a current circulating on the surface. And then the current induces another magnetic field that cancels the magnetic field within the bulk. Right, essentially, that's what happens. And in fact, from this picture, you see that there must exist non-dissipative current. Because once this, if I put in this time-independent magnetic field, then there has to be, because I want to repel my magnetic field, there has to be a surface current that circulates around and not decay. So, and this phenomenon of repelling magnetic field is known as Meissner effect. And as I've shown you here, Meissner effect automatically implies the existence of persistent current. Yes.
Does that mean that superconductors are like perfect mirrors, like facing a wave? Should it be?
Yeah, so that's why superconductors are also sometimes called perfect diamagnetism. Perfect diamagnetism. Because it always perfectly sets up a magnetization that exactly cancels the magnetic field. And it turns out the other way is not true. So that's why sometimes people say Meissner effect is more intrinsic for a superconductor than the existence of persistent current. Because I can set up, so there are two ways to set up the Meissner effect. The first way is to say, is to have a superconductor existing, and then you put in a magnetic field. The magnetic field gets repelled, and then a persistent current gets set up on the surface. Yes?
Can I just ask, could you repeat what the circles are that you drew on the superconductor?
The circle?
What's on the surface?
This means there is a current flowing this way.
On the picture, you have like the, meaning like something's coming in and out.
I'm saying there is a current moving this way, and then the current is moving this way. So once you have a current moving like this, it generates a magnetic field. That magnetic field is responsible for canceling out the applied magnetic field. Sometimes that's known as the eddy current. So this eddy current. Yes?
So in the first drawing, how the current is, like going.
Sir?
How the current is in the first drawing?
How the...
It's pointing out the current.
Yeah, it's pointing out or in. Let's see. Curl B. Yeah, that probably should point in. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, as I said, Meissner effect implies persistent current, but the other way is not true. Because I can imagine another setup, which is, let me start with a normal metal. Let's say if I start with a temperature greater than Tc, then if I apply a magnetic field, it will just, okay, the metal will still have some response, but it's not gonna be as drastic as completely repelling the magnetic field. So let me, to zeroth order, just assume that it's uniform. And now let me gradually just keep the magnetic field fixed, but then gradually cool the system down to temperature less than Tc. What happens is that once you cross Tc, this thing happens. The magnetic field line gets repelled. So this process can't be explained just on the basis of the existence of persistent current, right? Because here you don't have current to begin with.
then why the later case cannot be explained by the persistent current?
Oh, because in the metallic phase, you don't have persistent current.
But after the superconductor phase, you have current.
Yeah, that means somehow you have to generate a current once you cool, once you cross that temperature,
yeah.
that critical temperature.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's more than just the fact that when once you have a current, it stays there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Someone asked, how is the Meissner effect resulting from this, these eddy currents?
Yeah. So once you have an eddy, so following these equations, it tells you that Meissner effect should happen. But then the physical interpretation is it will on the surface there will be this current that generates another magnetic field that cancels the magnetic field inside the bulk. Now the non-trivial thing about superconductor is that exactly that kind of current is guaranteed to exist, right? In a metal, if you apply for example, maybe this is a better way to say it. Suppose I have a very clean metal, right? A relatively clean metal. What will happen if I shoot a magnetic field? Let's say if I turn it on in time, so that generates a electric field, and that can generate some eddy current as well. Right? And then once the eddy current is generated, the magnetic field within the metal will be smaller than the magnetic field outside. But that current will die out once you wait for long enough time, like tau. Right? And then you're back to square root one. You're basically, this picture don't have it. But in a superconductor, that eddy current doesn't die. So you're always guaranteed that the magnetic field is zero inside the bulk. So now let me comment a little bit. I think it was asked before. So the difference between a superconductor, which is typically what happens in metals, and a neutral superfluid. Things, for example, in liquid helium. So heliums are, for example, helium-3. So heliums are charge neutral. Right? So both are characterized some order parameter that breaks the particle number conservation, U1 symmetry. For example, in helium-3, it's also a Cooper pair condensate. Right? Helium-3, it's also true that the fermions are gapped. So the low energy excitations are also gapped Vogel-Lebesgue fermions.
Are those Cooper pairs also formed by pairs of electrons?
Yes. Pairs of helium-3. Okay. So the thing about superfluid is that they don't couple to EM field. But we can still turn on a background or probe field. To probe the physics. For example, this A will be basically another term or another number I introduce into my free energy. Right, for example, can be done by modifying your Hamiltonian. But that means this A does not have Maxwell dynamics. Which means your J is no longer tied to the double curl of A, right? Because that's set by the Maxwell dynamical equation. And as a consequence, there is no such a thing as Meissner effect. Yes.
So in this case, can you have London equations?
Yes, that's exactly the thing. But London equations still make sense.
But in the London equation, you pure gauge. But if we have some sort of external field, we cannot treat it as gauge field.
Well, you can still treat it as a gauge field. It's just non-dynamical.
So
right.
There's a mix between the phase angle and the external field.
Yes, but still, you can treat this as a gauge, and it is more subtle here, and in fact, that's partly why the London equation, it's better to keep it this way.
I see.
But for many purposes, it doesn't hurt that much, but still, it's better to keep it up. So there's no Meissner effect, but there is still a persistent current. Essentially. Persistent current exists. That's why it's called a superfluid. Also, another fact about neutral superfluid is that the fluctuation in theta gives you a soft mode. Because if I neglect, yes?
Physically, what is this persistent current for this case?
It's still the current. It's still that thing.
Oh.
Yeah.
So in the superfluid, it just means there's no viscosity of the fluid, right?
Yeah. You can still talk about conductivity. All right. So fluctuation in theta gives you soft mode. What does that mean? If I neglect that A, if I don't turn on the A field, the free energy looks like something like this. Okay. If you recall your knowledge about scalar field theory, that's a massless scalar. Which really means that, right, let's say if I move to Fourier space, it looks something like this. So the energy cost is arbitrarily small. As k goes to zero.
So here, rho as we take the T temperature to be near zero instead of near the critical part.
Yes, yes. Reasonably below TC.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, that's when you can neglect amplitude fluctuation.
Yes.
Okay. And so it's called massless boson. If viewed as the 2 plus 1D field theory in Euclidean signature. And this boson has a name. It's called the Goldstone boson. Or Goldstone mode. And in fact, I won't show you the proof, but the proof basically goes in a very similar logic as how we derived this action to begin with. In fact, this is a general feature of a spontaneously broken continuous symmetry, SSB of continuous symmetry. In this case, it's U1. And in a superfluid, that this mode also has another name. It's known as the sound wave or phonon. It's essentially the density or current filtration. Yes.
Could you explain why it's called soft mode? Like, what is the terminology?
The energy is small. If k is small, soft means it's energetically cheap, basically. For example, the amplitude mode will not be soft, because no matter how small your k is, your momentum is, there is at least a gap of order 1 over c. All right, so then you can ask, what happens with this ghost on in a superconductor, in a charged superconductor? So we certainly didn't talk about ghost on or sound wave in a superconductor so far, and there is a reason they don't exist. Reason they don't exist is because this gradient theta fluctuation in a superconductor leads to a current fluctuation. It's essentially the current. And the current fluctuation, because of Maxwell dynamics, leads to a magnetic field fluctuation. And a magnetic field fluctuation, because essentially this fluctuation couple together and get things damped. And then followed by London, leads you to another current fluctuation. And if you plug in essentially the same equations we derived for Meissner, which is behind the board, you get something like 1 over lambda L squared JE equal to Laplacian JE. It's the same equation for A, for B, and for J, because they are proportional. Linear, which means this JE also gets damped.
In the superfluid, these goldstone modes, they correspond to sound.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a name.
What does that mean, right? Like, because the superfluid is not supposed to have any viscosity. You turn on some field, and suddenly there's sound.
No. You don't have to turn on a field. There exists sound. Right. The existence of sound mode is not in contradiction to superfluidity. In fact, it does mean something. It means your zero, the fact that you have zero viscosity breaks down if your fluid is moving faster than sound. Because now you can excite sound wave and then create dissipation. But as long as you move slower than the sound, you're fine. Right, so this relation basically means the boson gets a gap, or gets a mass of order 1 over lambda L.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
I just want to make sure I'm okay. Is this J and this JE the same thing? So like in your implications, we have like a theta fluctuation leads to a J fluctuation, then to a B, and then back to a J.
Yes.
And those are the same J's again.
Yes. Right. Yeah, because I think here there's a derivative here. But so if you put in the derivative in the correct order, you get something like this.
Sorry.
Yes.
Can you interpret this J lambda L as the same order as rho S?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, okay, I have to be a little bit careful. I'm using Gaussian units, so in the normal unit, there's a mu zero somewhere.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but other than that, yes. Yes.
Question is back to the Meissner effect.
Yes.
The current length, the field length.
Yes.
Here we always treat the field classically, but
yes.
If we're sending photons on our superconductor, what's happening? We quantize our field.
Yes.
The effect, like they're going around. The
photons have a mass inside the superconductor. That's actually the next thing I'm going to say. But okay, that's not exactly the next thing I'm going to say. Close enough. I'm going to say the classical version of that. But turns out the quantum version basically is the same. Because to do quantum, yeah, because I'm doing a, because if you notice in that F, there's no time. Right? There is a way to include time into that. Essentially, you do a full 3+1D part integral there. And that in fact, you have to do that if you go to low enough temperature. And there you'll see that the photon actually gets. So here we do the classical version, which is not only the Goldstone boson get a mass, the gauge field also gets a mass. Again, of the order lambda L. Right. It's because if you formally write this term as two rho s a tilde square. And now if you include this term to your Maxwell, 4e square or 2e square, I forgot, f mu nu square, that represents a massive vector boson.
Mass of order lambda L instead of 1 over lambda.
1 over L. Oh, 1 over lambda L. Because
okay.
It's 1 over L. Mass is 1 over L.
Wait, but this is just a relic of how we do the gauge transformation. Different gauge, different mass, I guess.
No. The mass is gauge invariant. You can't say different gauge, different mass. So this is a quick and dirty way to see you have a mass for your gauge photon, right? So you can object that this term doesn't look gauge invariant. That is because you have fixed a gauge. Right? You have to fix a gauge to say to absorb this grad theta into your vector potential. So this term doesn't look gauge invariant. But within that gauge, things are sensible. Right? You can see directly from this that there is a mass term of the gauge field. If you want to do it fully gauge invariantly, you should do this.
And this is our free energy?
Yes. Now, for example, since I'm not doing anything in time, so this f mu nu square is really just a b square with some mu zero somewhere. So if you like, the action looks like this, and then you can solve the propagator. It's something again like k squared plus m squared. M is of order 1 over lambda L.
Okay.
So this gives you a massive vector boson. And this whole thing is also known as the Anderson Higgs mechanism. And it basically works for other gauge group as well. Right.
So, you have to apply a field to see that the field becomes massive.
What do you mean?
Like physically, are we applying a field to the superconductor?
No, the thing is the current and the field are coupled.
Right.
So if you have a current, it generates a field automatically.
Right.
Yeah. But you can, of course, also apply a field. See what happens.
Like in general, like in material, it's got like microscopic electric fields and like
sure.
Lots of things going on.
Sure.
So you keep generating massive stuff there, like in just normal.
The excitation gets damped out.
Yeah. I mean, massive excitation means that the excitation is not easily generated. It's the exact opposite of saying you keep generating.
Oh.
Yeah.
So the Higgs here is the phase,
you know? Oh yeah, the Higgs scalar, if you like, is the phi. Theta is the phase angle. And actually, well, okay, depending on what you mean. So the fluctuation, there are two fluctuations in phi. One is theta, one is the amplitude fluctuation, that delta absolute phi. So as I said, the amplitude fluctuation is eaten by the gauge field, and delta is the massive mode that you can measure. And the delta absolute value of phi is the analog of the Higgs boson people actually measure in colliders. Of course, there the gauge group is not U1, it's U2 or something. But the idea is basically the same.
So the physical interpretation would be that fields inside this superconductor will be suppressed.
Yes.
Just because
it gets a mass, that's why the fact that it has a mass means the correlation function has to exponentially decay. So if you start with some finite field, it will exponentially decay into zero. Yeah, that's the Meissner effect. Yeah, so basically Meissner effect and Higgs mechanism are the same thing.
Sorry, I'm a bit lost. Is the mass of the vector boson big or small?
Sorry?
The mass of the vector boson is big or small? Compared to the other one.
Sorry. Say it again.
Is it the mass of the vector boson is big or small?
Oh, this one?
Yes.
It's this number. It's compared to what?
Yes, it's big or small.
The only other scale, the only other length scale, yeah, that you can since compare. With this, it's this one. Right. The Fermi energy will be too large.
Mm-hmm.
The Fermi wavelength is going to be too small for this. But it does compare sensitively with this correlation length. And in fact, it's sometimes bigger, sometimes smaller. And depending on whether it's bigger or smaller, it's called type 1 or type 2 superconductor. But usually it's of the same order. Actually, that will be next month. All right. Any questions so far? Yes.
So the mass was associated with fluctuations in phase. Theta.
Yes.
But we call the amplitude fluctuations the Higgs.
It's basically. Okay, one thing I didn't tell you, not to confuse you, but since you ask anyway, the fact that in this argument I've absorbed delta theta into the definition of A implies that this Goldstone boson not only it's not just the Goldstone boson and the gauge fields become massive boson, they actually become the same massive boson. Right, because what's massive here is not the original A itself, it's A minus delta theta. So you shouldn't count these two modes separately, in fact. Yeah, maybe I should have said that. Maybe it's not that confusing. It's actually the same mode.
So where does the amplitude fluctuation come in?
No, the thing is once I say it this way, the fluctuation of delta theta is actually the same as fluctuation of A. So the mode associated with this is actually the gauge boson, W boson, and so on. So then you can say, what is the Higgs scalar that people measure in LHC? It's not that mode. It's the remaining fluctuation, delta absolute value of theta of phi, which has another mass. That mass is given by 1 over C, it's a different scale. So that's the Yeah, so that is a slightly tricky thing. So a condensed object is not actually measurable, The only thing that's actually measurable is the remnant of the condensate, which is that amplitude fluctuation. Yeah, that's why in the literature, sometimes that amplitude fluctuation is called the Higgs mode. Okay, more question? Yeah, all right, if not, okay, it's late enough, let's not take a break today. So let me tell you one fun stuff. Okay, hopefully these are all fun stuff. This one is pretty fun, it's the flux quantization. So imagine the following. Suppose I have a holo geometry. So I have, if you like, a thick cylinder of superconductor. Okay, so I have superconductor within this area, but here is vacuum. Outside is vacuum. And now I apply a magnetic field. So here there's some magnetic field, here there's some other magnetic field. But as long as the magnetic field is not too strong, everything I said makes sense, and the magnetic field within the superconductor should be zero. But now let me ask, how much magnetic field can I have within this holo? So the total magnetic flux within the holo, that I can measure by Stokes' theorem as the line integral of the vector potential over this circle, right? But now let me finally remember that my action is this, which means if I'm in thermal equilibrium, I minimize with respect to theta and so on, I should have this equal to zero. That's in thermal equilibrium. That just means I don't have current flowing. I don't have net current flowing. But what does that mean? That means that this, there's a two here. Yeah, there's a two, right? This means that this number is also equal to 1/2 the line integral of graph theta. Then you may say this is zero because it's the integral of total derivative. But remember, theta is only defined mod 2 pi. It's a phase. So this number, in principle, I can be 1/2 times 2 pi times integer. So now let me actually put in the right unit. Basically, 2 pi here, if I put in that h bar, e, and c, this 2 pi is the flux quanta. And let me remind you, flux quanta is h over hc over e. So what you see is hc over 2e times the integer. Okay. So what does that mean? That means this. If I actually set up the physics, let's say I actually have a holoed cylinder, and then I try to shoot a magnetic field into the hole by applying an overall magnetic field. Right, so what I will see is this. So this is the total flux trapped in the holo. This is the applied magnetic field. What you will see is a bunch of steps, because this number has to be an integer. And by measuring the unit of each step, you can actually see that it's hc over 2e, not hc over e. And this number 2, if you trace it back, it comes from this, and comes from the fact that there's a 2 here. So that number 2 comes from the fact that the condensate carries charge 2e. So this means that it's a 2e condensate. And that's how people know for sure that the superfluid formed in the superconductor has fundamental charge 2e, not e. Okay. So so by the way, this is actually experimentally seen. I'm not making it up here. And let me just, before finish, let me just say that this can also happen spontaneously inside a superconductor. That is this can also happen within a superconductor bulk without you having to make a holo by hand. By making spontaneously a region non-superconducting. A holo of a non-superconducting region, which is a normal metal. Okay. So that's what happens basically if I shooting a strong enough magnetic field. So the picture looks like this. So I have a superconductor, but then there is a small region here that becomes non-superconducting. Essentially, the delta, the gap, vanishes in that region. And there I can have a magnetic field trapped inside. So this region is a normal metal with a B field. Okay. Again, phi in this region, within this normal metal region, will be given by phi 0 over 2 times n. And following the same argument, you see that away from this region, if I measure something called the winding number of the order parameter, which is defined as this, the same thing there. That's given by 2 pi times n. So if n is not zero, this is known as a vortex of degree n. And this is sometimes also known as an example of what's known as a topological defect. What's non-trivial here is this non-zero gradient theta is very hard to get rid of. Right? So suppose I have a local patch of non-uniform theta. Let's represent the theta by a vector in plane. Right? It's an angle variable. So if I have something like this, then it's not too hard to make them uniform, just do a little bit of shuffling. Okay. But if I have a situation like this, what happened is arbitrarily far away from this point, I still have some non-trivial winding of this theta. So if I want to get rid of this theta, I have to do something much more drastic. Right? I can't do any local operation to get rid of it. So that's why this is stable. Even if it's not, and the fact that the theta is winding means that theta is not defined at the core, at the vortex core. Right, because if it winds by 2 pi, what's the value of it at 0? Right? Can't define it. Which is fine, because at the vortex core, the amplitude of this of the phi field is 0. So if the amplitude is 0, its phase angle is not well defined. So there's nothing wrong with that. And so next time we'll look more carefully at this vortex object for the consequence. Yeah, that's it for today.